taxation number 21877, rule 3.
Grammar rule 3.
Right, the following afternoon, evening, it was our turn. And we boarded our gliders. I don't know what time we took off. And the atmosphere wasn't subdued. It was still rather excited. We didn't want to miss anything. We didn't, there's no traces of fear. We didn't really know what was, we really didn't know what was in store for us. The second operation we did, we knew. But there was no fear, there was just excitement, anticipation. Off we went. We had a very, very uneventful journey to Ranville, or Ranville as we used to call it, on the banks of the River Orne in Normandy. As we flew over the beaches, we saw these puffballs, which meant that some unfriendly Germans were firing at us, but not near us. There were no glider shots shot down over on our journey over Normandy, as far as I know. Although there were some, but I wasn't aware of any being shot down. We weren't rocked by close explosions or anything, but we saw the ships down below firing. But it looked ever so quiet. All you could hear was the rush of wind on the fuselage. We were being towed by Dakota, and he used to sway up and down. But we were accompanied by the fact there's a very strong presence of Spitfires and Hurricane and other aircraft to defend us. And it was they say down below, it was a wonderful sight to see the whole division coming in by glider, or the air landing brigade coming. And don't forget the parachutists had landed during the night to secure the landing zones for us, because a lot of the landing zones were equipped with these tree trunks and telegraph poles and things stuck in the middle to stop the gliders coming down using the field. But they're the parachuters' job is to capture the area and clear the glider obstacles. Time came for us to be cast loose. It was a thump, and then what they call a dive approach, where the glider pilots put the nose down and you go down ever so fast to avoid enemy fire. And then we saw the landing zone at Ranville in front of us, and there was still a lot of glider poles there. But the glider pilots had practiced this system of landing between them, which is a bit of a shock, because they aim the fuselage between them and you're brought up short by the poles, or to snap the wings off. So we landed with a crash of splintered wood, and we got out, because you're very vulnerable when you first land. So we've had to kick the door open. Some of the gliders, they couldn't detach the noses to enable the jeeps and the trailers and guns to be pulled out. But this is I was an infantry company, therefore we had no jeep with us at our particular platoon. So we ran to the edge of the field. Everybody was running like hell to get away from the gliders in case they were mortared. And then we saw the very tall figure of our divisional commander, General Gale. And I'll never forget a smile on his face. What did he say? Welcome to France, gentlemen, he said. We landed 6 minutes early, 6 minutes to 9 p.m. And through the trees there was an unusual shaped tower. And we ran and got all our division equipment together. The company commander's jeep had landed another glider. There were smashed gliders all over the place. But the amazing thing is that we only lost one man out of the whole battalion by an unlucky mortar, a German mortar explosion. Everybody else was safe. So we ran, formed up, and marched to the outskirts of Ronville, where we started to dig in to await further orders. It was dark by the time we'd finished digging, and it's about 11 o'clock at night, and suddenly there's an awful, awful crashing, explosions going off in the field next to us. So we jumped into our trenches, thinking we were being mortared. To our relief, it was the whole of the brigade, all the mortars, 3-inch mortars, had been brigaded, which meant they were all together and they're all firing on a target. And what we thought were explosions were our own mortars going off. And so we had a very fitful night with all the noise going on from the beachhead, because we were quite away from the beachhead. But the parachute boys all over the place were, you know, attacking various enemy, and the enemy were attacking. You know, there was a lot of shots going on, an explosion. And then the German Luftwaffe came over, banging away at the beachhead, because we were reasonably safe. Because the Luftwaffe came out at night, because the RAF couldn't do night flights, because we hadn't captured any airfields, so they were still supporting us during the day mainly. Came the morning, various companies got different orders and different objectives, and we marched through just in front of Longueval on the shore, on the banks of the Orne, which was our objective. Another company, C Company, had to attack a village, Saint-Honorine, which had, we were told, just a few machine gun posts. But when they attacked, we found there were about 3 or 4 self-propelled guns and 1 or 2 tanks. They had a bad time and lost quite a few men. Now, as far as Longueval concerned, our particular objective, we laid a line on the edge of a field of corn, and there was Longueval in front of us with a high wall round this end of it. And we were told there was going to be a barrage to help us. So we waited, and then we were told that the forward observation officer couldn't get hold of his ship, the Arethusa, I think the ship was, to give us covering fire as we went in. And after a lot of delay, they said, right, the covering fire's coming. And then we heard a boomp out at sea and a rushing sound, and 1 or 2 shells landed near the village, not on it, but near it. And we thought, well, that's the bracketing fire. We waited. That was a bloody supporting fire, 2 bloody rounds of the Arethusa. So we had to go in without any, we didn't know what was in front of us. So we played our way through the corn, and we were firing, not at any particular thing, just to keep any enemy troops' heads down. And there's a small thing, there are 2 mistakes I'd found out already, mistakes in training. One, we hadn't been sufficiently educated in the firing of our own weapons and the firing of the enemy. But once you got to know that, a lot of your fear went out of your life. Because you heard thump, 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 thump in the mortars. And you know within about 7 or 8 seconds there'd be some, you know, stuff come down. And then you heard boom, boom. There's a big gun a long way away. Then you heard a rushing. If it's going over your head, it's like a big, big projectile. It's like an express train going over your head, and then a crash. If you hear a crack, that's a bullet passing you, and you won't hear the bullet which hits you. And then the thump of the rifle. crash, thump, you know, the crack and thump. We should have, that should have been pointed out to us when we were doing duty on the butts in rifle ranges. You hear the crack, you know, where the bullet hits, and then the thump of the rifle a second or so later. And later, after we were being plastered by naval guns from big guns, German guns, you heard the boom. And then you could wait about 10, 12 seconds. You had plenty of time to take cover. In fact, you got plenty of time to take cover with a mortar if it's somewhere away. And the second mistake was in weapon training. We never had an all, no matter which battalion I was with, we never had a lot of ammunition. You couldn't go mad with ammunition in training. And as a result, we were never taught what to do when you had to fire a lot. Now, my personal weapon was a Sten. You fire a magazine, about 20 rounds, I think it is then, I don't know if you're up there. And then what you should have done was take the empty mag off and stuff it inside your smock. But we were throwing them away. Taking another magazine, we were throwing half our magazines away. So we reached the Longueville, no fire was coming back, and eventually it wasn't defended. So in the next few hours, we were going back to the cornfield, picking up all that bloody discarded magazines, you know, which tossed away.
Why was it necessary to have the empty magazine?
Well, to refill them. You had about five magazines. But if you throw them away, you won't have any of them to fill. But we hadn't taught that because we never had an enormous amount of ammunition in training. But that's a small thing. So we defended Longueville. We dug in on the banks of the river. And heard about the disaster which had struck C Division, C Company. They lost about 12 men. 30 were missing, but most of them rejoined later. And at this point, I must say, the Germans were better trained than us in quite a few things, but especially in disposal of the dead. Now, we were never taught anything about the dead, your own and enemies. And as the weeks wore on, you saw a lot of our own and a lot of the enemy, and the tendency was to leave the enemy where they were and throw dirt over them. But of course, with our own men, dead, you detach one identity disc and they're buried with the other one. We learned that. But the Germans were meticulous with our dead. And in every place we went back to where we lost men, we found they were properly buried. They buried our dead, most often than not, with crosses made up of branches of trees, branches of bushes and things, with either the identity disc or the equipment, because our equipment had our regimental numbers stamped on the straps, in case not because, to identify you, but because of preventing one bloke from pinching somebody else's equipment. But that was draped over the grave, and which is rather bad, really, because they weren't all that bad here, Germans. Very, very well trained soldiers, very well equipped, far better equipped than we were.
In what sense?
For the weapons of first class. Although, I would prefer the Bren gun to the MG 34 and 42 of the German, because they're a very involved gun, lots and lots of spare parts. Whereas with a Bren, that was they were made in Czechoslovakia, in a place called Brno, and modified in Enfield, Bren. Now with a Bren, you could take it to bits, not an awful lot of bits, put it together again, and you could only put it together in one way. If it wasn't put together correctly, you couldn't fire it. You could throw it into a sand pit, wash it off with water, or blow on it, and off she'd go again. You know, and easily controlled bursts, a very good gun. Whereas the MG was, it was a scatter gun really when it landed. But the Bren, that was a disadvantage. It's a bit too accurate. You had to wobble it around a bit to make a nice cone of fire. Because if you're not careful, but it's sub the right range, would go into one hole. But their tanks, outstanding tank. Their tanks were pitiful compared to theirs. I think we were fed better than the German. Now, our assault rations, that's for the first 2 days, the last 2 days, were in a cardboard box, and there were oatmeal blocks, meat blocks, tea, sugar, and powdered milk. There was some lavatory paper, and spoiled sweets, and then that they fitted nicely into your rectangular mess tin. But after about 3 days, up come the lovely compo rations, and they were in cardboard boxes, I think, four or eight men, I think, and they had tin sausages, tin bacon, fruit, lots and lots of toilet paper, army form blank as we called it, sweets, the Americans absolutely adored our compo ration. Of course they had their own sea rations, which were, you know, meat in little tins and things. Then you learnt how to cook in the field. You used to have a petrol or biscuit tin. You filled it up with earth, you pour petrol on it, and standing well back, you toss the match into it. And that burned enough to do quite a lot of, if you want to do an oatmeal block, for example, you can either eat it raw or make a nice mess tin full of porridge. You had small cookers to pour a cup of tea from the stuff. It's very, very good. We had biscuits for the first 2 or 3 weeks, this army biscuits. And as was on after a week or two, we're all complaining about gums hurting. Teeth aching, and then each man got, after about 2 or 3 weeks, each man got 2 or 3 slices of white bread. The loaves were dished out as a ration. And there's no mistake, we take our bread for granted, but if you're deprived of it for about a couple of weeks, it's absolutely wonderful. Ordinary bread, used to eat it raw, or with a lovely Normandy butter, camembert. There weren't many inhabitants left there, because I think the Germans had evacuated them. Very few, all the farms were deserted. The cows were dead in the fields after a week or two. And there they were, all blown up with their legs sticking up in the air, like we've seen in the recent foot and mouth cattle disposal. We were occupying, D Company was occupying, as I said before, the trenches by the side of the River Orne. And from then on, for some weeks, it was a question of real First World War warfare. We were living in trenches, sleeping in trenches, fighting from trenches. We were being mortared, practically surrounded. On 2 or 3 occasions, we were surrounded. The Germans had cut off us from the rest of the division. We were mortared, we were shelled by our own troops, unfortunately, on one occasion, when Canadian artillery had seen movement on the at Longueval, because we were on a kind of hill, and thought it was Germans, because the Germans all around us, and they shelled us, and that was my first horrible job. I think it's because the RSA wasn't too fond of me as an ex-guardsman, and I was on the first burial party. We had to gather all the fragments of bodies, but put them in their blankets and bury them with a short service in the grounds of a chateau nearby. But that was dreadful. Blue on blue, I think they call that these days. Very distressing. There were patrol actions. On the 3rd of June, I went on my first fighting patrol, a whole platoon fighting patrol.
3rd of June? 3rd of July?
Did I say July? June? 9th of June? I thought I said the 9th of June. 9th of June, 3 days after D-Day. We were taken by our company commander, Major Dybal, a fighting patrol, a platoon of I think about 30, 40 men, a half a company, quarter of a company, one of the full company. One company was doing an attack at St. Honorine, further over. But we had about 30 or 40 men divided into four parties. The major had one party, my friend Ginger Begg had another, I had one, and our platoon commander, Lieutenant Malcolm, had the other. And we went to march along the riverbank, the Colombelle, went through a chateau grounds, came onto the village itself. Two parties stay behind, and Lieutenant Malcolm and my parties cross the road. We talked to some French people there, find out whether there were any Boche there. We didn't realise until much later, we were on the outskirts of Caen there, which wasn't captured for a hell of a long time later, but we were on the outskirts of Colombelle. We were the troops the furthest in, but we didn't know about it. But they say there were no troops in the village, but there were some just about 400 or 500 yards away. While we were talking to them, they rushed up and said, "Boche coming." So we all got into positions, not to fire on a Boche, but our business was to see if there were any enemy there. So I got my 7 or 8 men to hide behind some houses, and the others did the same. The major was the other side of the road, the safe side, on the riverside, the towpath side. Ginger Peg was with him, and Lieutenant Malcolm was on my left. And suddenly, to my horror, along comes this German jeep with an officer standing up in it. I saw him go by. Then some marching men, about 7 or 8 went by me. And they got a bit further along, and I heard an ear-splitting bang as a bloody grenade. This bloody major die ball. Instead of waiting till the party had gone by, he'd thrown a grenade at the jeep. Because all hell broke loose. Just 2-inch mortars going off and shouting and screaming and bullets popping away all over the place, machine guns going. And then it went on quiet except for the moans of the wounded, German wounded. I looked out. And there were about 5 or 6 bodies laying in front of the gate, which we had to go through to get over a wall to get onto the towpath. And then it went all quiet the other side where Major Dybal and Ginger Peg were. They'd gone back to the towpath and gone. There's Lieutenant Malcolm and me left with our party. I didn't know where the Germans were by then. So there's just the odd rifle shot going off every now and again, not from us. And we crept to the hedgerow by the road, and I was looking up the road towards St. Honorine, where the troops had been marching from, and there about 30 yards away from me, the German soldier standing up in the aim. And I let fly with my Sten, and I don't know whether he fired or not. He dropped. I don't think I hit him, but I dropped, you know, to get out of the way. And it went quiet again. And then I caught over the bloke who had a smoke grenade. I said, throw some smoke. So I threw two or three smoke grenades, and the smoke, you know, gradually came up. We waited a minute, because you're always taught to fire into smoke. Nobody's smoke. So I said, right, go. So we belted over the road. And I've got to confess now, although we were always taught this, never to trust people laying down, face downwards, because the Japanese are very good at this. So as I went by, I brushed on both sides, you know, banged away at the bodies laying there, whether they were dead or wounded. But what I remember is the nearest German was an enormous bloke next to the gate. And there's his big hobnail boots, you know, with his knee-high boots. And he was wearing a British Army airborne smock, the same as we did. So he must have taken it either off our dead at St. Honorine or some of the parachute blokes who landed during the night. So we got through into the Chateau Grains, so we ran, and I stopped to gather them all together. And then an officer rushed up, I think it was Lieutenant Malcolm. He said, this way, Sergeant. I said, no, they could probably pass that way. He said, this way. I said, I'm sorry, I'm not going there. Going further into the village where the troops are. I'll be on this way. So we started doubling again to the towpath, onto the towpath, and walked and marched. The road walks and runs are very useful training for this. And we walked and ran back to the battalion. Halfway back, I looked to see if the people were still behind me. And there at the end was a bloody officer. He never mentioned it, the episode again, and neither did I, because I could have been court-martialed for that. We got back about 20 minutes after the rest of them, we got there. And then the Germans closed in on us from four directions, and we were cut off again, been mortared badly. And that went on like that, two or three attacks on us, which brings me to the point of the 70th Battalion. Boys, I was telling you about. We didn't recall that, did we?
No, you were telling me off the tape, if you can start it from the beginning.
Well, here it comes. About a couple month or two before D-Day, we got a reinforcement from the 70th Battalion. I don't know whether it's the London Irish or the London Irish at Territorial Battalion, or the Royal Ulster Rifles 70th. But he came through. Their issue with their red berets, although they'd never done any glider training, and they kicked up out of light when they're off duty in Salisbury. They're always in trouble. Dreadful lot. Big mouth, always swanking about being airborne, all the rest of it. Well, boys about 18, something like that. Maybe. I don't think they were younger. 18, 19. And then the battalion, the 51st Highland Division, he come from North Africa, about two or three weeks after D-Day. There's a big fuss in the paper, the 51st Highland Division have landed. And all, you know, nothing about the 6th Airborne Division or anything. And then a battalion, the Cameronians or some Scottish battalion, came through. They were going to attack St. Honorine, where the attacks of our battalion attacks on St. Honorine had been repulsed, because the Germans had been reinforced. And they had to go through, a brigade of the division were attacking. We put in a company, they put in a brigade. And I and Ginger Peg had to take different units, different companies, up by safe routes to a forming up area before they put in the attack. And on the way up, it's dreadful. There was our barrage from the army gun and the naval gun coming down one way, and the German defensive fire coming the other, and you didn't know which was which, really. And they looked a bit shaky, this mob I was taken up. or one of them said, "You see our train unit attached to an honorine," you know, all this bullshit. They were heavily laden with full-size shovels. We always use our entrenching tools, but they had shovels and pickaxes. They were heavily laden. The way they went, and we came back. And then about 2 hours later, an awful row. I was an honorine direction with a shell fire and a shooting. And then about an hour later, they were back running. They were...